I never got any money from you.
UFO might just as well stand for unprecedented financial opportunity.
Be normal.
This is The Saucer Life, a podcast in which we examine concepts, events, or people orbiting the world of flying saucers. Few preconceptions, snark when justified, no belief, no debunking. And this episode is the conclusion of my road trip to Missouri, my vaguely UFO-themed road trip to Missouri. So it's not one of our usual style episodes, just like last time wasn't, where we looked at a little bit more about Buck Nelson's history, or trying to find that history through want ads and the fact that there are apparently many people named Buck Nelson in the world, which is kind of confusing for our purposes. But today we're going to conclude this by looking at a couple of other areas in Missouri that I visited, what I saw there, and what else had happened there in the past, what had brought me to those places as places to find just the landscape and the feel for the place. So that's what we're doing today. So, after I was done Buck Nelson hunting in the greater Mountain View, Missouri area, I decided to check out the general region of an area known as the Marley Woods. Now, where this is was always kind of vague. The investigators who originally looked at it didn't want a bunch of people coming in and causing trouble, but this is an area that had numerous reports of poltergeist-like activity and strange lights and UFO-type things and even some animal mutilation sorts of stories running around in the late 20th century. So I did some checking around, and one of our listeners basically clued me into a little bit about where it is. In generally this is one of those times where I suddenly forget things while I'm recording and don't have time to edit. Oregon County, Missouri. And this listener used to live in the area, and she told me that there was a cemetery. She told me the name of the cemetery that was a place where she would go, and she and other people saw, if I'm remembering this right, saw interesting, strange, mysterious lights there. So on my way through this county where strange things happen, and this is in sort of the midst of the Mark Twain National Forest. It's hilly, it's wooded. I would not want to drive this at night because it's very sort of sharp turns and lots of hills and some narrow dirt roads, as I found making my way to this cemetery, which sort of on top of a hill surrounded by pastures with grazing cows and a very nice, well-kept, fenced-off cemetery. And it was 9 in the morning, so I didn't see any strange lights. Now, I don't discount the idea that strange lights might have been there and that I simply couldn't see them because it was 9 in the morning. But it was very interesting to be there. I like cemeteries, which seems like an odd thing to say, but I'm a history guy. So looking at cemeteries and graveyards and looking at the stones and finding the oldest ones and trying to figure out, you know, when all of this might have been plotted out and when this became a place where there were enough people in the area to start burying their dead there in an organized sort of commemorative fashion. That's an interesting thing to me as a history guy. So I took a look at that, spent some time there, talked to some of the cows. I always talk to cows if I can. I don't know why. Maybe I feel like before I eat them, I should talk to some of their relatives. I don't know. It might be a sort of carnivorous sense of guilt, perhaps. So I drove through Oregon County, this area that was, you know, you know, identified as at least part of this Marley Woods region. And I did stop off to do some hiking in the Mark Twain National Forest, a place called Greer Spring, which was a great hike, sort of right down into a ravine and then sort of hiking your way right back up with a great spring and river and sort of a falls rapids area down at the bottom. So that was nice. Nothing paranormal about that. It was just a nice hour spent hiking. Next, I made my way to, honestly, very nearby Piedmont, Missouri, a town of a couple thousand, maybe 3,000, that was in the news recently for the 50th anniversary of a case, a constellation of cases that occurred in early 1973. There were over 500 reports of UFO sightings in the Piedmont, Missouri area. Again, nestled in the Ozarks in the Mark Twain National Forest. There's an article about it on an old archived MUFON site that has the sort of beginning line or has the line, "Southeastern Missouri seems like an unlikely place for something so out of the ordinary." What? Actually, no, it doesn't. These things happen all over the place. And in sort of mountainous, heavily forested areas, actually, that's exactly the kind of place I would expect something out of the ordinary to happen. So it's February 1973, and a number of people, over 500, see and report strange things in the sky. It began on February 21st of 1973 when basketball coach Reggie Bone, which is a great name, is driving his basketball team back home to their homes. That's a dumb way to say it, after they lose a tournament game. And they are on US Highway 60 and about 20 miles south of Piedmont when Bone, the coach who was driving, noticed, quote, "a bright shaft of light beaming down out of the sky." And a few miles later, one of the players named Randall Holmes noticed something else, and he said, "Look, I think that's the same thing we saw." So the coach pulls the van over to the side of the road, and the team gets out of the van and starts looking up in the sky. "It looked like it was about 200 yards off the road, hovering over an open field," Bones said later. Investigators from the International UFO Bureau of Oklahoma City later estimated the object was probably about 400 feet above the ground. "It was impossible to determine the size or shape because of the darkness. Anyway, we saw four lights that looked like portholes, red, green, amber, and white. We figured they were about 3 or 4 feet apart, all in a row. We stood there and watched it for about 10 minutes, Carrie Barks, another witness, added. "Then all of a sudden, the lights went directly up in the air with absolutely no noise and just disappeared over a hill." Less than an hour later, a woman named Edith Boatwright of a town near Mill Spring, rather, which is not too far from where the basketball team was, saw the same thing, or the same sort of thing, flying low over her farmhouse. "It was about 10 p.m. I was lying on my bed. I wasn't asleep when I saw a flashing light. We live close by the highway, so I thought something had happened on the road. I got out of bed quickly and looked over the lower part of the curtain, and I could see very plainly a craft just clearing the utility wires. It was in a horizontal position. I think there were people in it. I could see objects inside, but I could not make out any form of a person. It made a very quiet noise like a whoosh, slowly and evenly. When it changed into a vertical position, it made a louder noise, like a quiet motor pulling. It didn't have any chopper blades on top like a helicopter, just some rotary-type blades in front where an umbrella-like part extended up. It was about 30 or more feet long. Very beautiful, light-colored body with a darker tail. There were no lights on in our house at the time. I watched it for about 1 or 2 minutes. It was about 200 or 250 yards from my window, flying below the oak treetops." Mrs. Boatwright would have other sightings at her farm over the coming days during this wave. the next day and the day after would see more and more sightings. These would continue almost nightly until late April. So from late February to late April, the Piedmont police receive over 500 reports. And it's pretty amazing. These quotations you're hearing, I'm getting from this archived MUFON site, which reprints the Fate magazine article about this. And what's great about this article is that it's a really good piece of coverage about these sightings. But also, it points out that this is the first major sort of widespread UFO thing to hit the news after the Condon Committee makes their ruling that UFOs aren't worth the Air Force's time. And also makes the point that these 500 sightings in a concentrated area over a relatively long period of time, it rivals any of the famous UFO waves of the 1950s. And it says in this article that clearly UFOs will be as important to the 1970s as they were to the 1950s. And I don't know if it really turned out that way, although the 70s were a big decade for ufology. And I think we're kind of due for a 1970s sort of focused episode. We've done little bits and pieces here, but sort of an overview of the decade might be fun or might be terrifying and turn into some kind of four-part epic kind of thing. Now, J. Allen Hynek, who of course is no longer working for the Air Force, but was still a UFO guy, came to Piedmont in March of 73, talked to some people, spent some time there, and suggested that what had been seen in some of the photographs that had been taken was a lens flare, which the photographer denied. And also photographic experts at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch newspaper sort of said, we don't think this one's a lens flare. This doesn't look like a lens flare. Her lens was coated to prevent lens flares. But as usual, trying to take photos of UFOs it's never going to work out. No matter what you do, they either look like absolutely nothing that can't be explained, or just for benefit of the doubt, they look so realistic that they are clearly, you know, a hubcap or a lampshade or a wood and paper model that later homeowners find stashed in your attic. But in any case, lens flare or no, you've got 500 sightings over a period of months, which is amazing. And so you've also got other experts who sort of go into this area and try to find trace evidence of these things. One of the most well-known in this area was a guy named Harley D. Rutledge, who was a physics professor. He had a PhD in solid-state physics from the University of Missouri and then was the chair of the physics department at Southeast Missouri State. And during this time, he headed up something called Project Identification, which was a team of observers using all kinds of equipment, including telescopes and audio detectors and EM frequency analyzers and cameras to measure variations in the Earth's gravitational field as a way to try to explain at least some UFO sightings. And often what were found were things called pseudostars, which are lights that are sort of hidden in some way by the usual constellations. There's a book that came out in 1981 called Project Identification, the first scientific study of the UFO phenomenon, which, if I can get a hold of it, is going to be the subject of a future episode. Professor Rutledge died at age 80 in 2006. So, you know, this is a significant constellation of UFO sightings that have gone on here in 1973 in Piedmont. And I'm not going to say they were unknown. Of course they weren't unknown, but they weren't, from what I saw and just in my experience, they weren't among the most well-known for many years, or the most talked about. But like I said, this is the 50th anniversary year here in, I almost said 1996. I have no idea why I almost said 1996. Here in 2023. And the town of Piedmont celebrated this with a conference, festival, party thing in April. I wish I would have been able to go to that. But on the Saucer Life social media, I've taken a couple pictures from around town that I've shared there. And there's one, a painting of a classic gray alien colored green, holding a mug of beer, painted on the side of a bar. You've also got on the front windows of the town newspaper office a whole bunch of headlines and posters and promotion for Piedmont as being a UFO hotspot. And indeed, there were efforts in the state legislature to declare Piedmont the UFO capital of Missouri. So it's an amazing set of stories, and the town, at least for the 50th anniversary, seems to have made a concerted effort to cash in on this. Now, I don't know that this is necessarily a bad thing, despite, you know,
UFO might just as well stand for unprecedented financial opportunity.
It's only really a problem if you're actively ripping people off or manipulating them. And I honestly, I don't think doing things like selling a book is that, because the money exchanged is for the actual book, right? But I like the idea of UFO tourism if it's done well. And everybody's opinion is going to differ about what something like this being done well would look like. Is it more scholarly? Is it more entertainment focused? Is it more of just a town festival that happens to have UFO themed decor? There are examples of all of these different types of festivals out there, but there are a lot of places. And I think honestly, a place like Point Pleasant, West Virginia is one example where, you know, when economic times get tough in a particular area, you've got to rely on something to bring in revenue and to bring in people willing to spend money. And when it's done well, and when it's a case that enough people have heard of, and there's something there for them to see when they go, UFO tourism can make sense. I'm not sure it would work in every case. I'm not sure some events are big enough to draw a big enough crowd to make a difference. And like I said, there's got to be something there to be a draw, rather than on this empty field or on this stretch of highway, someone may have seen something back in 1973. I mean, I would go look at that, obviously, but you know, it's difficult to do UFO tourism well and sustainably. So any of you out there who live in areas that would be good targets for UFO tourism, I'd be interested in hearing what sorts of things you might have heard suggested or suggested yourself to the town leaders about doing something like that. So that was Piedmont. And that is the second to last stop on my trip. And after this short break, we will get back to the rest of the trip and a supposed crash in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. If you like The Saucer Life and you want more, you can support the show in exchange for bonus content. Patrons get the episodes before everybody else, and there are a few pieces of bonus content every month. And right now, there's videos and things related to the recent trip to Missouri and things like that. And the June bonus episode is going to be coming up soon, where I may actually be addressing modern, present-day, current UFO events, like whistleblowers who are saying completely unique and things that have never, ever been claimed before. So lots of fun stuff up there, more than a year's worth of material, well worth checking out at both the $2 and $5 levels. If you're interested, you can check it out at patreon.com/chizomedia or through the link in the show notes. Past episodes of the show are up at Saucer Life or on your favorite podcast app. As always, we're on Twitter and Instagram. You can email us at thesaucerlife@gmail.com, and you can contact us by post at Chizo Media, P.O. Box 68, Grand Blanc, Michigan 48480. Okay, and we had some feedback from our first part of the Missouri story. On the Patreon, Scott says, I've never heard of Flying Saucers R, but I did just buy a copy of a book with the equally puzzling title, UFO Exist, which sounds like an outstanding book. And Laura, also on the Patreon, reminds me that she was the one who suggested the revival of Buck Nelson's convention. And Laura says it's something she'd love to organize one day. And sort of coincidentally, emailer Lester said, shouldn't Saucer Life invent a holiday celebrating contactees? The U.S. already has tons of absurd holidays. Think of National Gorilla Suit Day. There's also National High Five Day, I'm just pointing out. There are already probably holidays for UFOs or flying saucers, Orthon's birthday perhaps, or Ashtar Day. And you could celebrate National Contactee Day either at Giant Rock or at Buck's Farm. And Lester suggests that the day for National Contactee Day should be October 12th, because it's Madame Blavatsky's birthday. And he says, remember, her Mahatma, Kut Humi, is part of Ashtar Command. Besides, the Psychical Research Society judged her the most fascinating charlatan of modern times. Clearly, she was a role model for many contactees, like Alexander Dowie was for Pentecostals in the early 20th century. I think October 12th, that would work. Madame Blavatsky's birthday would work. Might be a little, I'm not using this word in a sort of winking way or as a pun, but a little esoteric. I can see it. I don't hate that. I can't remember the exact date. I'd be terrible at inventing holidays, clearly. I don't remember the exact date, but whenever in, I think, November, Adamski had his initial contact with Orthon, I think that would be a good one as well. Michael from the Patreon says he wonders if there's any chance that Buck simply didn't know when he was born. And I think that is possible. I wouldn't be surprised. And along the same lines, Lester emailed that he was surprising that we could find the World War II draft card, but not a World War I draft card, because he would have been, Lester points out, 22 in 1917, definitely military age. And also, it's too bad that we didn't find any trace of Bo the Space Dog. He also wants to know if there's a space cat, space hamster, or space ferret. I'm not familiar with any contactee pets besides the space dog. If listeners out there are, please let us know through the usual channels. I don't know. Some of the beings the contactees talked to kind of resembled animals. There's the fish. There's the fish on the planet, on the Janos people planet. Maybe that counts. So that was some feedback. Thank you for that. Always like getting feedback and questions and comments from listeners about those sorts of things. And now let's get back to Missouri. So, on to Cape Girardeau, Missouri. Cape Girardeau is right on the Mississippi River, right across from Illinois. You can get some great views of the river down by the waterfront, and it's a nice town. I wish I would have had more time than just an evening to spend there. I think I rolled into town about 4 p.m., and I was gone about 13 hours later, very early in the morning for the long drive back to Michigan. But the reason I wanted to go to Cape Girardeau is because in 1941, there was supposedly a UFO crash in Cape Girardeau, near Cape Girardeau, outside of Cape Girardeau. And Missouri, I think Cape Girardeau resident Michael Huntington, who's written a lot about different UFO locations and things, has sort of pinpointed the alleged crash site. And in the pictures that circulate online of that, news stories and things like that, you can see the road sign. You sort of know where it is, the general area. So I had a definite possible field to drive by. So this is an interesting story. This crash retrieval and the story of how this Cape Girardeau crash got into the hearts and minds and souls of UFO types goes back to 1991. There's a woman named Charlotte Mann, and she wrote to UFO researcher Ray Fowler, who sent the letter on to a guy named Len Stringfield. Now, Len Stringfield is somebody that we have not had an episode about yet, but we are going to, because Len Stringfield was one of the first UFO researchers who dedicated vast amounts of time and research to supposed crash retrieval stories. And these stories are, of course, part and parcel of modern UFO mythology from Roswell on up. And Stringfield, you know, reads the letter, which is basically a story about how Ms. Mann's grandfather, who was a minister, received a telephone call. He was supposed to go to the site of an aircraft accident to pray over the victims of this. And Stringfield got more information, had her sort of write the letter out in a little more detail. And we have the letter online. Kevin Randall on his blog, A Different Perspective, has a nice article about this. And it's interesting because Charlotte Mann writes this letter, and she got the story not from her grandfather, but she got the story from her grandmother, who got the story from her husband, the grandfather. And no matter how honest all the people involved are, this is a second or even third hand story. It's not direct, which Randall points out on his blog. So it was the spring of 1941, about 9:30 in the evening, the grandfather gets a telephone call. There's a plane crashed outside of town. Would he go in case someone needs him? A car comes to get him. It's not a police car. Afterwards, she says, her grandfather explained what he had seen to the grandmother and her father and her uncle, but that they were to never speak of it again. Grandfather said it wasn't an airplane or like any craft he'd ever seen. It was broken and scattered all around, but one large piece was still together, and it appeared to have a rounded shape with no edges or seams. It had a very shiny, metallic finish. You could see inside one section and see what looked like a metal chair with a panel with many dials and gauges, none familiar looking to him. He said that when he got there, men were already sifting through things. There were some police officers, plainclothes people, and military men. There were three bodies, not human, that had been taken from the wreckage and laid on the ground. Grandfather said prayers over them, so he got a close look but didn't touch them. He didn't know what had killed them because they didn't appear to have any injuries and they weren't burnt. It was hard for him to tell if they had on suits or if it was their skin, but they were covered head to foot in what looked like wrinkled aluminum foil. He could see no hair on their bodies, and they had no ears. They were small framed like a child, about 4 feet tall, but had larger heads and longer arms. They had very large oval-shaped eyes, no noses, just holes, and no lips, just small slits for mouths. There were several people with cameras taking pictures of everything. Two of the plainclothes men picked up one of the little men, held it under his arms. A picture was taken. That was the picture I later saw. Then, one of the military officers talked to Grandad and told him he was not to talk about or repeat anything that had taken place for security reasons and so as not to alarm people. Grandad returned home, told his family. That was all. About 2 weeks after it happened, he came home with a picture of the two men holding the little man. After my grandfather died, my dad kept the picture and was very interested in UFO info. Then, when I was 10 or 11, a close friend of my dad asked if he could borrow it to show his folks, so dad let him have it and never got it back. I'll put a link to the blog piece that Kevin Randall wrote in 2019, because it's really good and goes into some really interesting stuff, which sort of points out that there's a lot in this story that is, in addition to being second or third hand, also just too good to be true. This photograph and later talk of, you know, trace evidence and physical artifacts and things like that. It's an interesting story that Randall has documented very well. So in Cape Girardeau, I did a couple things. I went to a couple places related to this. I found County Road 204, or road some highway 204 out near the Cape Girardeau Airport. Drove the length of that road, next to this field where this crash supposedly happened. I think I interpreted the photos correctly. I also went down to sort of into the city in Cape Girardeau and found the church where this preacher who supposedly saw this crash, Reverend William Huffman. He was a Baptist minister, and he was the pastor at the Red Star Baptist Church. He began being the pastor or minister there in 1941. Church records confirmed that. At this point, however, the church has closed and sold the property to a school system or a private school. It's some sort of school that it was sold to, but the address was the same. So I drove by and saw that as well. And one interesting story or aspect of this story is that in a lot of accounts that I read online, they talked about Pastor Huffman being asked to give last rites to the aliens, which is maybe not the least Baptist thing ever. I mean, but you know, no, last rites, that's a very sort of Roman Catholic thing. Praying with the dying, even praying over the deceased, you know, it's a questionable thing, and I'm not going to get into the theology of it, but I just am amused when they needed him to give the aliens last rites. It's like, that's not how the story originally was. I think that's people just inserting their own sort of thinking and interpretation into this. But it's a fascinating story, and it was really interesting to drive alongside that field and imagine what that would have been like in 1941 in the dark with fires burning as a fiery crash of a craft is sort of taking place. Is it true? I don't know. I don't know if we'll ever know. But fascinating story. Please check out the link to Kevin Randall's blog where he talks about that. So Cape Girardeau was the last stop on my road trip. And the next morning, I set out for home, and I had 10 hours or so to think about what I'd done, which makes it sound like I'd committed some horrible crime or done something very wrong, but to think about the trip and to reflect on it and to sort of compare it to some of my other UFO related trips I'd done, to Point Pleasant several times, or to Hopkinsville, Kentucky, and I think this compared favorably to those, because in this trip, when I started looking into Missouri, at first it was going to be, you know, all Buck Nelson all the time. That was my goal. And then I thought about, well, there's the Piedmont Lights sightings, and there's Cape Girardeau, and there's all the, and there's other things in Missouri as well. It's not just those things, but those are the things that I could sort of look at the map and sort of figure out how to do. So it was a fruitful trip, and it was nice to get out and away and to have some solitude. So I'm not sure I can say I urge everybody who's interested in this to go find an empty field where something might have happened and to stare at it and take some pictures for, you know, 20 minutes. But if you're the sort of person to whom that kind of thing appeals, try to do something like that. Even find something local and go and experience the landscape, even if you don't talk to anybody about it while you're out there. I hate talking to people, so I usually don't. But just to get a sense of what that place might have been like at that time, I think is valuable. So that brings us to the end of the road trip episode. And yeah, it's another short one. It's the sort of thing where doing the whole thing at once was just going to be too much, but doing it separately, there's no good place to divide it. So this was what we end up with. And next time it will be relatively normal service returning. As far as the next topic, I'm thinking it's going to be looking into Citizens Against UFO Secrecy, taking a look at that organization, its history over the course of a couple few decades. And we saw a little glimpse of what they were up to with Larry Bryant's lawsuit that we talked about in our last UFO magazine episode. So I think looking at Citizens Against UFO Secrecy and some of the personalities involved with that is where we're going to go. But despite this being a shorter episode, thank you for listening. Remember to send in your questions and comments, and I'll be addressing those next time. Our associate producer is Simpson J. Hanover III. The Saucer Life is a production of Chizo Media, LLC. Chizo Media, our heart is with the people and occasionally in Missouri. Till next time, keep watching the skies, because the skies are watching you.